Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. To this gray Seattle day today. What happened to our sunshine? I would like to know myself. Eric, do you have an answer on that? You're grabbing the mic.
It's coming back.
Well, good.
This is just a interlude, if you will.
Good. This is why we're all suffering with allergies, because it's 50 degrees 1 minute and 70-something the
80
next.
Later, yeah.
Yeah. Well, today we're taking a spiritual journey with a visionary and modern mystic turned novelist. And later we'll take a backstage tour of local theater with production director Dina Duncan. She's from the Whidbey Island Center for Arts. And coincidentally, they have some auditions coming up soon. So if you've ever wanted to tread the boards, maybe this could be your big opportunity. But first, I'm pleased to welcome Chanson Duval to the show. He describes himself as a modern American mystic. He currently writes and teaches in-depth meditation in Southern California. And he particularly is interested in students seeking enlightenment. He is the author of a novel described as a murder mystery that morphs into a spiritual journey. And his book is called Our Lady of Dreams, A Prophecy for the New Age. Chanson, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, I want to begin, Chanson, with some of your background, because your background actually morphed into what is now Our Lady of Dreams. And I read that you used to live in the deserts of Arizona, and when you were around the age of six, you started having visions and spiritual experiences. I wonder if you'd share with us what those share the very first one with us and what that was like and how you felt about it.
Okay, the first one was I was around six and a half years old, and we had moved from one house to the other, and there were several fields in between. It was in the desert, but it was also a ranch, but there were several fields in between the two houses, and the first house we moved from was empty. But I used to go back over there because I had become accustomed when living there to sitting on the back porch and meditating, even at that age.
Hmm.
And then on my walk back to the other house, our new house, I tripped on something, and I reached down, and it was a toy tin soldier, like you would see in the old days. It was all rusted, and I looked at the tin soldier, and then all of a sudden, there was a call up in the sky, and I looked up, and there was a bird, and it was calling, and I looked right at it, and at that point, I became all the children in the world. The whole world opened up to me, and I experienced the experiences of all the children in the world. On their suffering and the happiness and everything that was happening to them at the same time. And it was at that point that I realized that that the children are very important to the world and to the future of the world.
That
vision lasted for about 3 minutes.
What was it, a frightening vision for you? I would imagine it would be at such a young age.
I didn't know what to think of it. I didn't really say anything to anyone about it. In fact, I didn't really say anything to anyone about my visions until my 20s. And at that point, people were, would kind of not say much or not reply or not really ask any questions. So I just pretty much shut up about them until the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you been engaged in meditation and spiritual practices your whole life? Did you have a regular day job? Or, I mean, what were you doing as, I know you're somewhat retired now.
No, I'm not retired, actually. I'm an executive at a film studio.
Oh, okay.
And that's what makes it kind of unique. Because I've kind of led a dual life. I'm kind of like at home, I'm kind of like a monk, and then at work, I'm an executive.
Right.
But yes, I have been meditating my whole life ever since, because it just came natural to me. In fact, I used to go out in the desert when I was young and just sit under a bush and meditate for hours. And the only time I really, there were a few times in my life when I actually stopped. In my early 20s, I stopped, and then, mid-20s, I stopped, and then in my 30s, I stopped for several years.
Well, I want to talk about
periods when I didn't.
Right. And I wanted to talk about one vision in particular you had in 1987, because that vision requested that you tell the world of its prophecies. And you, I read that you first ignored that as a creation of, oh, well, I just imagined this. I just created this vision myself.
Right.
But then it returned again to you.
Yes, in 1990 or 91, I can't remember the exact year, but yes, that one in 1987, I was at for the first time, I was at the Metropolitan Art Museum in New York City, and I was in the Egyptian section, and there was a statue, actually there were several statues of Sekhmet there, was the Egyptian goddess with the lion head, and it was really strange because I was in this room, and I looked around, and I've always been very good about noticing things, and I noticed that people were leaving those two rooms. You got to remember, this museum gets like 100,000 people a day on average. And these people were leaving this room, and then the security guards left. And at that point, this tremendous power took over and just kind of took me to ancient Egypt. And I didn't realize it at the time, but she was actually speaking Egyptian, which I didn't recognize again until I heard Coptic on a PBS program one mm-hmm. time, and I realized it was a language, a similar language. But anyway, she showed me ancient Egypt and everything that had happened back in those days, and how happy the people were. And there were times when they were extremely happy, you know, for hundreds of years. And she told me in our time that people had lost that happiness. And she went on into detail, which I won't go into right mm-hmm. now. But anyway,
no, I know
she requested. She requested that I tell people the things that she told me. Well, I just kind of ignored it and didn't pay much attention to it. And then, so a few years later, I was in Malibu on vacation, and this voice came to me asking why I had not done what she requested.
And so you went ahead and started writing, right? You started writing this in the form of a novel.
Yes, at that vision, when she said, "Why have you not done what I requested?" Just immediately this plot came through my head, and I jumped up and ran inside and wrote down an outline of the plot, and then I didn't do anything for 6 months, and then after that I wrote every weekend, every Saturday and Sunday from 2 to 6 p.m. until the novel was finished.
Mm. Now, one thing I thought was interesting is that your protagonist, your lead character, is a female, and you wrote her voice in the first person. Was that challenging for you?
No, not at all. In fact, she was speaking to me. It's really strange because even though this novel took a while to write, there's no absence of flow in it, and the people just come alive in the novel. In fact, they become almost real personages, you know. She just told me what to say, and that's what I said as far as the character. I had absolutely no problem. In fact, women have congratulated me that I had such a good feminine view and the things that women go through.
Right. Now, you told us just about your visions that you had, and you were compelled to write this book, and you were requested to release the book. But then once it was actually written, you were reluctant when you were actually trying to find an editor and publisher. You say you were reluctant to actually let go of it, to let it go into the world. Why was that?
Well, because I am an executive, and I'm pretty high up there in the food chain, and I didn't really want people to know about my second life.
Right.
And it was really difficult. It's still really difficult to this day. But the thing is people enjoy reading the novel. I get a lot of good comments on it, and I think it has a purpose.
Hmm. If you had to sum up, I know you don't want to give away the plot, but if you had to sum up the message of the book, because this is a series of events that leads up to the countdown to 2012. It begins with a couple of diaries that your protagonist is an unassuming prosecutor, it says on the back of the jacket. She works in the L.A. District Attorney's Office, and the countdown to 2012 really started in the 80s when she learned of the murder of her brother, who was a New Age spiritual guru. What is the message when people have read the book, what message would you like them to be taking away with them, if any?
The message that a lot of people, and I don't know if you read that one review where the woman said it actually changed her life.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reviewer that said that, but the message that it takes away that it's that we're all responsible, that there's no one on earth that is not responsible for what's going on. And but it says it in a good way. It's not in a bad way. And it has a very positive ending, so I don't want anybody to not read it because they think it's going to have a terrible ending, but it has a very positive ending to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the message is that the divine intelligence does care, and that he or she, whatever your perspective is watching over us. And even though we have free will to do what we wish, their love, its love is there for us if we only choose to relax into it.
Mm. Well, that's a good message. I know you have a website, Chanson. Please give that out for our listeners before we leave you today.
Okay, it's actually in French, so it's kind of hard, which was a mistake on my part. let me pronounce it first, and then I'll spell it. It's www.bolrevspublishing.com, and what Bolrevs means is beautiful dreams, and it's spelled BEAUXREVES publishing.
Right. And I think if people type in Chanson Duval, that pops up too. At least it did for me when I Googled it.
Yes. If you go into Google and just type in Chanson Duval, you'll get all kinds of things, and you'll get access to ebooks and everything in there. You can read a lot.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you, and I appreciate you being with us today. Interesting story, and I wish you all the best with it.
Okay, thank you, and I hope everyone out there reads the book, and they're free to email me. My email is on my website.
Great. Thank you, Chanson. And my guest again, Chanson Duval, and his book, Our Lady of Dreams, A Prophecy for the New Age. And please do stay with us. We're going to take a wee break, and we'll be back with Dina Duncan. She's the production director from the Whidbey Island Center for Arts. What are you laughing at me, Eric?
Just when I hear we're going to take a wee break, it just, never mind.
Okay, I was the Scots in me. I've been talking with my sister-in-law. She's Scottish. We're going to take a little break, okay? We'll be right back. Bye.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com. Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, J.A. Jance, hailed as the undisputed mistress of the mystery novel. She has over 15 million novels in print. Vicki discusses her latest work and unparalleled success. Also, Dr. Alessio Fasano is a leading international expert on celiac disease. Learn the latest findings and best ways to cope with celiac disease next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives, all natural, alternative talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I'm joined in the next segment by Dina Duncan. She's a graduate of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. She holds a BFA in Theatre Arts and is currently pursuing a master's degree in nonprofit leadership at Seattle University. She's the production director for Whidbey Island Center for the Arts, and she's been there for more than 10 years. Busy lady. She's assisted the executive director in producing 38 main stage and 7 summer youth productions in the past 8 years. What a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. I feel pretty lucky, though.
Well, welcome, Dina. It's Dina, right?
Not
Deanna.
It is Dina.
Yeah.
Thank
welcome
you.
To the show, first of all. And I wanted to start off just by sharing a little bit more of your background. You have some very impressive credits. And have you always been involved in theater, I guess, is what I want to know, first of all. Have you always wanted to do theater?
You know, I didn't. I wanted to be a first grade teacher for my entire youth. And in fact, I had received a scholarship to a university in Utah when my junior year in high school, I had a teacher who said, as an assignment, you either need to try out for a play or you need to try out for the debate team. And so I tried out for the play and was cast and was immediately bitten by this bug and started auditioning. And on a whim, I auditioned for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And the fact that I got in is still unbelievable to me. Mm. Completely changed my life. And we'll talk about arts and education, I think, a little later.
Yeah.
But I think that's always a part, a core of who I am. But no, theater actually came really late. It's not something I didn't do. I wasn't in a children's theater. I didn't ever do it in my youth. It was something that really hit me pretty late, actually.
And what was that bug like when it hit you? It's like, was it, I've got to do this, nothing else matters?
You know, it was the safest place I'd ever been. And I think that people who do theater for a living and who I call them lifers, people who I know are going to be in theater forever, there's something beautiful about finding a place where you can work so much on yourself and your soul and who you are, and you can begin to connect with an audience and share with them. It's a basic part of humanity for me. I think theater is at its core. It's about humanity and connecting with other people.
Mm-hmm. And why did you choose local theater? Because there are so many avenues open to you.
There were, although it's a business like anything else. And I had a pretty successful professional career. I was on a hit TV show. I was on 30-something for 1 year, many, many years ago.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah, that was fun. And had some national and regional commercials and was working with a great professional company in L.A., Theater West. And then a couple of things go south, like it does for all of us. And I lost some funding, and I dropped out of graduate school at that point, which I want to tell everyone, do not drop out of graduate school. Keep going. Don't wait till you're 40 plus. It's really hard. And I stopped. I stopped doing theater for about 10 years, and I became very bitter and sad and mean, and I knew I had to get...
Oh.
I did. I had to get back into it. So
we've got your family here. Maybe we should ask them.
No. But it was... Getting back into it was as difficult as it was to break into it when I was young, and maybe even a bit harder because at that point I was 30 plus, and it's hard. So I moved to Seattle hoping to work with one of the top 3 regional theaters here, you know, ACT or Intiman or Seattle Rep, and it's really difficult. And I didn't get that lucky break, and wanted desperately to create a career for myself and believe in the power of the art form at any level. So I feel really lucky to be where I'm at.
Yeah, and you've been with Whidbey for 10 years now, so obviously you've found a good niche for yourself there. You are the production director right now. Share with our listeners what a typical day is like for you as production director.
Well, it depends on the time of year. In producing, as being a producing director, it takes about a year to put a season together. Right now, we're at the end of our fiscal year, and I'm just beginning to set that season with our executive director, Stacey Bergois. She and I pick all the plays, and then once we pick the plays and we hire the directors, we go through the audition process, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and then we really build the teams around the entire plays, all the costume sets, props, lighting designer, put those teams together, start having production meetings. When you're about 10 weeks out from a play opening, you're really starting to have weekly meetings and sitting down and going into rehearsal. And the plays run for about 10 months from September through June. So right now we're right at the beginning phase of this next season.
Right. So the season is September through June then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you don't have much downtime really. I guess all that downtime is planning and preparation for you.
It is planning. And summer, we're usually teaching summer camps and summer classes with the youth this year. Was a little difficult, like most nonprofits, and not even arts-related, but almost all nonprofits who have camps. The numbers are down this year, probably because of the recession and the amount of money available. So we had to cut some of our classes, and those we had were fantastic. But we've had a little bit of a downtime where we've been able to clean and organize. We have a brand-new facility. We just are in the midst of a capital campaign, so we're moving into our new black box rehearsal hall. very excited about that.
Oh, exciting. Now, do you still act? I read somewhere that you're taking a class with, her name's Stella, isn't it? I recognized her name when I saw it.
Stella Adler was, well, I believe, I'm very biased, the best acting teacher that the United States ever saw. I graduated from her conservatory. She has a conservatory in L.A. and in New York, and I was lucky enough to work with her. Actually, I think I was 26 when I was with Stella, but she formed the basis of classical theater training in the United States, and her studio works with NYU with the top graduates in acting right now in the United States.
Interesting. It's pretty exciting. Now, talk about some of the plays that you've put together. You, 2008, you co-produced Twelfth Night and directed the wrestling season. Excuse me, my voice is trying to hold on here. The wrestling season for Whidbey Island. Other local directing credits include Emma Reeves' Little Women and Nosferatu, Legend of Dracula.
And Sweeney Todd a couple of years ago. That's probably the one I'm most proud of because I'm not musically trained. I've done a few musicals, and yes, I do still act. But to be able to direct Sweeney Todd, which I always go for story. That's the first thing I look for when we're choosing a season mm-hmm. or where I'm looking at a play to either direct or to act. I look at what the story means. And Sweeney Todd was just the depth of human good versus evil. And to have a chance to work on that was amazing.
Mm.
Yeah, so I always go for story. Little Women, what was interesting about that, Emma Reeves is a playwright out of England. She had written a new version of Little Women to make it more accessible to the stage, and we were the very first production in the United States to do her script, so that was very exciting.
Oh, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the actors, if you would. Are they professional? Are they a mix of pro and amateur?
We see a mix on Whidbey Island. We have people who are very well trained and who have performed professionally for their entire lives and for whatever reason are on the island or are not performing now. We also see people who have a little bit of training. We see people with no training but a little bit of experience. I think that's what makes this level community theater really exciting, is that there's opportunity to work side by side and really raise the quality of what you're doing. And I really do think it's a legitimate form of theater. And I have this argument in the Seattle theater scene a lot that if you're non-union, if you're not in equity theater, you're not professional. I completely disagree with that. I call us non-union, not non-professional.
Right. It's a non-profit organization, isn't
it? We are.
And you're taking non-profit leadership in Seattle U. Is this to help you grow this organization? Or?
You know, there were a couple reasons I went for the degree. There was an arts-specific degree, and I pulled myself out of that because we all had the sort of the same problems, and I found it so much more dynamic to be in a room with other nonprofit leaders who are working with the homeless and working in domestic violence and realizing that as a 501c3, the arts are mandated by federal law to give back to our community. And to remember, we're not just doing this to put on a play or to just create entertainment, that we really honestly believe that this art form can create change and help people deal with mm-hmm. problems. And we need to remember that. We need to reach out into our communities and to other nonprofits and do some real work.
Mm. So how does your nonprofit keep alive? Is it mostly through sponsorship, federal grants, state grants?
Like all nonprofits across the nation, we have different funding streams. And right now, and I think this is pretty normal, individuals carry about 75% of our funding stream, giving to us either by buying tickets or by becoming members of the theater. We do have corporate and foundation grants. I think that sits at about 8 to 10% of our annual budget. We don't receive very much government money. For the government money for the arts, you do need to be a union house. That's something I'd love to see change. That's mm-hmm. something I'd really like to fight for across this nation, that we see the National Endowment for the Arts open up their pocketbook to the non-union houses. I think we deserve it.
That's interesting. I did not know they have to be union to get to
well,
get funding.
There is some for us, but nowhere near the amount mm-hmm. of the union houses. It's mm-hmm. much harder for us to qualify for that NEA national money. That would be a great national conversation to have.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I know you have some auditions coming up for the
yes.
next season. I want to throw that open to our listeners. We want to talk about that a little. And please do stay with us. We're talking with Dina Duncan from the Whidbey Island Center for Arts, Stuttering. And my name is Vicki St. Clair. You're listening to Conversations Live. We'll be right back.
Now she cries with a cigarette at the window.
He grows and moans like he's hurting.
He
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune in to our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I don't know where you found this music from, Eric. Thank you. And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my special guest in this segment is Dina Duncan. She's a graduate of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and is currently the production director for Whidbey Island Center for the Arts. She's been over there for the past 10 years and produced some terrific work. Let's talk about the auditions you have coming up.
Yes.
I know you've put a call out for auditions, so tell us all about that.
Great. So season auditions happen on August 17th and 18th. For two nights, there are five-minute slots. Actors who want to come in and audition sign up. If they're auditioning for one of the two musicals, which I'll talk about in a second, we would ask for about 16 bars of a song. Otherwise, we ask for a three-minute monologue, or if they don't have anything prepared, we can read them from the script. So those are called sides when you just read from the script. So you sign up for an audition slot. If you receive a callback, that's when a director wants to see you specifically for that show. The callbacks are the next three nights, so we ask that actors keep those nights open because they'll be called back usually for multiple shows. It takes about a week to go through that casting process to find out if we need to put another call out. Usually we get about 80 to 85% of our casting off of that this initial season. Yeah.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And how many people do you end up signing up?
Well, it depends on the season and how many shows. Mm. I can tell you about the season that's coming up. We're really excited in October. We're opening with Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog.
Okay.
Which
I've seen that.
I know. Which is, it's really an amazing story because Joss Whedon, who's best known for writing Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and Firefly, he wrote this during the writer's strike in Hollywood as a way to say, we can do quality work without the studios. I know we can do this. And he gathered incredible friends of his and family and wrote it. And it went completely viral. I think 2.2 million people watched it in the first weekend.
Right.
And he's just released it for theaters. And we will be the second theater in the country to be given the right to do the entire show. Many people have done songs from it, but we're really the second. And we talk to the Whedon clan, as we like to call them, every couple of days. We're still trying to figure out how to get the music because it's not a written piece yet. So we had to adapt the script and work on the music. But if there's anybody listening who loves Dr. Horrible, we are looking for people who love Horrible to come out to Whidbey Island and help us produce this piece and show Whedon that we know how to do it. So.
Well, how about you, Eric? Eric's a singer.
Yeah, come on out.
I'll tell you a funny story about Dr. Horrible. I went to a friend's birthday party and they said they were going to be watching films. And I got there a little late, which she knew I was going to be late because I was working. I got there late and everybody's silently watching this. It was Dr. Horrible. And I was like, what the heck is this? And then they paused it to tell me it had been a viral video. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was actually quite funny. It really was quite funny once I realized what was going
on. It is. It's two superheroes fighting for domination and the love of a girl. And it's good and evil. It's fantastic. So if you love Dr. Horrible, please come out or check out our website, wiccaonline.com. And then in December,
let me just ask you, any age limits on the auditions? And
no, we have roles, actually, because we're doing Oliver at Christmas. We have roles down to age 5 up to 105.
Oh, wow.
So in Horrible, we're looking, because it's a pretty adult piece, so we're probably age 18 up on mm-hmm. Horrible. But I'd be willing to, I'm sure that the 17, 16-year-olds are the ones who are going to know the piece really well, so I'd love to talk to them.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so what else is coming up?
So Christmas, we're doing the hit Broadway musical Oliver, and again, that'll have a lot of youth in it, which will be a lot of fun and allow the opportunity for them to be on stage. And then in February, we are, again, this is something I'm really proud of. Wicca is gaining a reputation of being able to win the rights to plays that are hard to win. And nationally known playwright Teresa Rebeck, she's had her pieces on Broadway. She's probably the most produced female playwright in the nation right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm pretty safe saying that. And her piece, The Understudy, was done in New York, and we will be the first non-union house to have it. And are really, really excited about that. I call it a backstage look at everything Broadway. I don't know if you know the play Noises Off, which is sort of a spoof on theater where anything and everything that can go wrong on stage does. I call this one The Next Noises Off. It's everything difficult about producing a play. And then we're doing our first Shakespeare piece, Twelfth Night, which we're really excited about. And we're closing on Shakespeare's birthday, so we hope to have a big Shakespeare birthday party.
That sounds fun.
Yep.
Yeah.
We're closing with a piece called Metamorphosis by Mary Zimmerman. It's Ovid's tales and myths being told mostly through movement. There's going to be a full pool of water on the stage. When it was done in New York, it was almost like a gigantic swimming pool. I don't know how we're going to do it. You know, it's my job to figure this out.
Right.
At the very worst, we'll have a little kiddie blow up pool, but I hope to do better than that.
I have one I bought for my dog and he doesn't use it. You can use that.
I'll call you.
So are you involved in all of these plays at some level, or do you like each take a certain play and
I'm involved. It's my job to head every single play. I mean, I have the best job at Wicca. So I sit at the head of that production team and make sure that everything's happening on schedule, on time, and that we're ready to open. And I do say that theater has the best track record of any industry in the world. We always open. We never aren't ready to open. Well, I wouldn't say we're not ready, but we always open.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you talked a little about the spoof, about everything that can go wrong in theater. Tell us, if you had to talk about an almighty screw-up on opening night or something, what springs to mind for you?
Well, there are two, because both as an actress and as a producer, there's a lot. I think as an actress, one of the most horrific things that ever happened to me, but I look back on it fondly now, is I was in a touring production of the musical The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and I was playing a dancing like cowgirl, and my wig had been pinned to my cowboy hat, and my dancing partner took my cowboy hat off my head and was supposed to put it on his head, but my wig went with it. So he put it on his head and he danced to the other side of the stage, and I could see my hair go with him, and I knew that I had this wig cap on my head, and I had to finish dancing and leave. And that's when I stopped wearing wig caps on stage. I refuse. I won't
wear them.
Yeah,
I was going to say, did you have a wig cap, or at least did you have your own hair?
Nope, but I don't wear them anymore.
Yeah.
I make sure. I've never had another problem with wigs because I almost staple them on my head now.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
That'd be funny.
And then in theater, there's just a million. I mean, we've had actors not show up on time, and we've put other people in their costume and placed them on stage ready to go and had an actor come in late. And as producer, you're sweating bullets. You don't know what to do. Or you see an actor in a scene. Actually, I can't watch from the theater anymore. I have to go up in the booth. But you'll see a scene where an actor forgets a prop and he leaves the set, and he leaves an actor on stage who's supposed to be in a scene, and they have no idea what to do, and they start making stuff up. And you scream, and I sit on the floor sometimes and just scream. That's why I can't be in the theater.
Right, right. I guess that's where good improv skills come into play.
Yes, definitely.
You have a lot of classes at Wicca I wanted to talk about, too. Tell us a little bit about some of the classes.
Well, we've started an education component, which is part of the capital campaign. As I was saying, we were able to we've raised $2.2 million of a $2.5 million capital campaign, and we've built a Black Box Rehearsal Hall, New Scene Shop, Costume and Prop Loft, expanded dressing rooms, and we're finishing up the campaign in order to build the new administration wing. But part of that was all about education and being able to reach out to the community in a bigger way. And what we're seeing happen on South Whidbey is the district, the school district numbers going down. The demographics are changing out there. And as the numbers go down and the school district begins to lose more and more money per student, they begin to cut programs. And, of course, one of the first things they cut are the arts. Mm-hmm. And we really see a need to collaborate and to reach out to them and to be able to offer classes and workshops. And we'd like to do it tuition-free. We'd like to not, which means we're going to have to really take on that burden and raise those funds and find those sponsors and find the corporations. But that's our goal.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about some of the actual classes. I have a list of them somewhere. I've got so much stuff off your website.
Well,
I like this one, building confidence and self-awareness. People don't think about that in acting, but it's very true.
That's the core of why we do it, I think, especially with youth. And in fact, I would like to challenge anyone who has a youth in their life, whether they're a parent or an aunt or an uncle, and they're struggling. If that youth is struggling academically or socially, the arts, and of course I believe in theater, can really, really help, because the team building and the self-confidence that you're given affect you everywhere else in your life. That's why I believe it's so important.
Mm-hmm. How do we get schools more involved in theater and arts? I know so much of their funding has been cut, and I know this is something you're passionate about too, and I believe arts should stay in the school for a myriad of reasons, but why do you think it's so important?
Well, for that reason, that the kids who struggle for a variety of reasons, whatever's going on in their home life, whatever has not sparked them. And I believe and I've seen that the arts can change their lives and can give them direction and can give them hope. And I think that the schools are overburdened and overworked, and I think it's our duty as the nonprofit organizations and the nonprofit arts organizations to reach out. And that's one of the reasons I'm back in school, to try to figure out how to create these programs so that we can help.
Well, hopefully we can start a couple of conversations today, and one of them being the school funding. How do parents reach out to the schools to express their desire for this in schools?
I again would encourage them to look within their communities, maybe within 10 to 15 miles of where they live, at what arts organizations are available, and chat with them, and then go together as a team effort. If parents are in collaboration with the arts organizations and can go to the school district and can show collaboration, that will really help.
Mm-hmm. I used to love drama at school. It was my favorite class. I didn't want to go to anything but drama or PE when I was a kid. My English teacher was our drama teacher, and we were quite happy with, doing that, having that fun break from regular learning.
Yeah, although there's clear research that says it's not a break from regular learning, that everything that you're doing in the arts wires a certain way in your brain that allows you to do the math and do the science at a higher level. I mean, there's wonderful, wonderful books, Your Brain on Music, and that really shows the correlation, and I truly believe that.
Yeah. Well, let's take a little break, and we'll come back and we'll continue talking with Dina Duncan. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Laundry day, see you there. Under things, tumbling. Wanna say, love your hair. Here I go,
I'm
mumbling. With my freeze ray, I will stop the world.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. If you have comments or questions on any of our shows, we want to hear from you. Email info@conversationslive.net. Call Vicki toll-free at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or leave a message at our special listener voicemail box, 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
How you make me feel, what's the phrase? Like a fool, kinda sick, special needs, anyways. With my freeze ray,
and welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we're taking a peek into the theater today. We're going backstage with Dina Duncan from the Whidbey Island Center for the Arts. I need to get that out in front of me, so make sure I get it right.
That's right.
I said that right. Also, we're referring to it as Wicker, nothing
yes.
to do with the pagan
no.
religion. You told me a couple of funny stories during the break. Let's share those with our listeners.
Well, I had forgotten about 4 winters ago when the big snowstorms happened, that the electricity had gone out, and we were in the midst of producing Little Women. And a lot of people, some of the actors and a lot of people involved in the show said, well, we should just not have the show tonight. And it was less than an hour before curtain. I said, no, well, of course we're going on. The show must go on. We're going to do that. Like, well, what are you going to do? So I think we had something like 200 candles, and we put them in jars. We put them all around the stage. We asked everybody to bring blankets to the theater so everybody could be wrapped up because we knew the heat wasn't going to be on. And we did the show, and it was absolutely gorgeous. But one of the actresses, they were wearing big hoop skirts, mm-hmm. and she walked near one of the candles, and one of the candles went under her skirt. I was in the booth.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was screaming, candle under her skirt, candle under her skirt. So I grabbed the headset, and I went on with the assistant stage manager downstage. I said, Marilyn's coming off. She has a candle under her skirt. She's going to be on fire. Catch it. and somewhere from her walking from half the stage to the stage left to getting off, the candle sort of slipped from under her skirt and was fine. She never knew about it.
Mm.
I don't know if the audience saw it. I was terrified that my actress was going to go up
really?
In flames. Yeah.
So she wasn't thinking, oh my gosh, it suddenly got warm in
no,
here.
No, she never knew.
Oh, that was amazing.
Yeah,
was what about funny. Your other story? Tell us that other one.
Well, this is personal. It was I was 17 years old the first time I was in a play when I was a senior in high school. And I had never kissed anybody before, and I was cast in The Rainmaker, and this boy, who, of course, I thought was gorgeous because I was in a play with him, and he leans in, and he's supposed to put his hands on either side of the wall. We're in a barn, and he leans in for the kiss, and the wall fell down. And, you know, I didn't care because I got my first kiss, but I will always remember that because the audience, of course, went up in laughter.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
So how do you recover from something like that? You just pretend it didn't happen? Or?
No, and I wasn't very well trained. None of us were. So I think we laughed through it, and we took a small break and got the wall back up and continued on. I think if it happened now, oh, I don't even want to think about it.
Part of live production. I mean, we're live every week. It's, you know, we
yep.
have our own little disasters, not quite with scenery or everything. But so tell me what, I know you, I can tell you're very passionate about this, about the work. What is it that drives you to keep growing with the art?
Well, there's a famous quote, I don't know who said it, about if you're lucky enough to find your passion, you should follow it for the rest of your life. And I know that I was really, really lucky. I can't identify how I was brought to theater, but I know that I'm in the right place and I'm doing the right thing. And I know this is how I've spent my adult life and how I'm going to spend the rest of my life. There's
mm-hmm.
no doubt that I'm going to be in theater. And it's what I'm interested in now is how to help others find that spark. And I do believe the arts are a vehicle to help youth find the spark, whatever it is. Even
right.
if they're not going to be artists, by participating in arts, we can find what their core value is and we can help them ignite that.
Yeah. And what do you tell people who whose kids maybe, or even to the kids themselves, who want to go into the arts, who want to act or produce, and their parents say, it's not realistic. This actually happened to me. You asked me earlier if ever I've acted. And I used to do a lot when I was a kid. I actually wrote 2 plays and had them produced as well when I was a child. But when I was 12, everyone kept saying, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be an actress. And everybody used to laugh at me. So I thought, okay, that's a stupid thing to want to be.
Yeah.
What do you say to people about that?
Oh, if you can, don't listen to them. It's hard. It's really hard. I was lucky. My parents, I say allowed me to go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, but they were worried. They were very, very worried. I had a scholarship to become a teacher, to become a first grade teacher, and they really felt it was going to be a difficult life, and it has been. I mean, this is not something that you choose knowingly. It chooses you. And you're still performing. I mean, you've still got the bug, right?
Right.
But I think what I've told youth is that there's a way to pursue it. You can still go to school for those other degrees in math and science and still participate in the arts. Don't stop. Don't
right.
stop. That's
right.
the number one.
And what personally would you say has been your biggest challenge? Because I think we all have turning points in our life. And obviously when you found theater, that was a big turning point for you. But, you know, we can go either way in that mm-hmm. road. What's probably been your biggest challenge along the journey with your art?
I think realizing that what you bring to it is the most important. That for me, again, it's all about story and wanting to connect with people. And so when I went from what most people would call a professional career to this term I hate, this non-professional career, there were a few years where I completely gave up. Well, if I'm not going to be on TV, if I'm not going to be famous, if I'm not going to have the big, big shows, then, you know, I'm not going to do it. But having the guts to sort of say, I'm going to spend my life in this art form at any level that I can and find the truth and the joy in it. And it's happened again. You know, I'm 45, and there was a time right there at 40, which is probably a natural transition area for us as women. But there was a time where I was like, what am I doing? I should mm-hmm. go get a job, and maybe I should get a degree and be a lawyer. And, you know, I was like, no, right. why would I do that?
Right.
You know, I'm going to follow my passion. But I think we all have those ups and downs and question our choices all the time. And it just gets down to taking the time to reflect on our lives and reflect on our core values.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look good on it, so obviously must suit you, and it's a good cause for you know, sticking with it and living your dream.
Thank you.
What about influences? Who have been some of your biggest influences?
Well, the biggest influence right off the bat was Stella Adler. She changed my life, and she was the one who really took me down to the basics of acting, where it wasn't about performance and it wasn't about getting the audience to laugh or getting the audience to cry. It was about connecting with what I was trying to say to them and to hear what they had to dialogue with me about from that. And she was brutally hard, brutally honest. And I walked out of her classes many times thinking I would never survive mm-hmm. the art form. But by far, I'm still hugely, hugely influenced by her. And then I was lucky enough to learn directing from Bart Schur, who was the artistic director at Intamon and has gone on to the Lincoln Center and has won Tony Awards in the past couple of years. He took 8 of us a year through Freehold Studio in Seattle and worked with us for about 9 months. So there's only a few of us who had the opportunity to work with him. And because I didn't study directing, I studied acting. So Bart is my directing influence, and I'm heavily influenced by him. I call it my Bart-isms. I do things. I'm like, Bart would like that.
You've had some great mentors.
I have. I'm really lucky. Mm-hmm. I'm really lucky.
And what about people on screen or on TV or theater, actors, working actors? Who do you admire in those fields?
You know, I watch a lot of film, and I'm just beginning to love film. And I think, like everybody, Meryl Streep just blows me away.
Yeah,
you know, I watch
yeah.
her. But what I'm really interested in now is listening to her when she goes out and she writes blogs or she gets interviewed, and really listening to what her influences are. And she does so much homework and background work before she steps on stage. And I love that. The research, I think, is where you really create your character. So she does that a lot. I've just started to really like Sandra Bullock. I think that she's sort of hit a stride where mm-hmm. where her honesty is coming across. And on stage, I think that it's more companies than people. I really keep my eye on South Coast Rep, on the Guthrie, on the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. I really keep my eye on the type of plays they're choosing, who they're bringing in, both directors and designers, because I think they're doing the highest quality work in the country. So I keep my eye yeah. on companies.
I actually used to live in Stratford-on-Avon, where the big Shakespeare theater
wow.
is. So we'd go out drinking at night after work and be hanging out with, like, Patrick, well, not hanging out, but, you know, sitting next to Patrick Stewart
yeah.
and Dame Judi Dench.
Oh, that would be incredible.
And, yeah, a whole bunch, all the big, big.
Yeah, and who would know Patrick Stewart, right? I mean, he can do Star Trek, and he can do, you yeah. know, and Shakespeare. It's amazing.
Yeah, it yeah. is amazing. What do you think of them? I was in a store the other day, and you know how they have I can't remember the name of it because it's a long time since I was at school. They have these little cheat books that discuss Hamlet or or any kind of Shakespearean play or a novel. You know, the yellow and black
ones.
Yeah,
I do.
Well, I saw a different version that has modernized Shakespeare. What do you think of that?
Wow, I would have to see it. I'm not a big fan of those. I do believe that we need modern adaptations. Folger Library out of Washington, D.C., their Shakespeare texts have new adaptations right side by side. And I think that if you're studying Shakespeare or if you're being cast in a Shakespeare, I think Folger's Library is probably the best script to get for that reason. I would have to look at it. I think Shakespeare should be done as close to his language as possible. Mm-hmm. How you want to produce it, I think you could do anything with
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. I do, too, because part of the thing about Shakespeare is he had an incredible vocabulary. I think it was like 5,000 words compared with, I don't know how many we have, but nowhere near that
nowhere
amount.
Near. Yeah.
So that was the big thing with him. Let's talk a little about rejection, and then we're almost at the end of our show. Right
okay.
Now. How do you handle rejection? Because obviously this is one of the industries where you get a lot of it.
This is funny. We just talked about this in class at Seattle U a couple of weeks ago. It's hard, and it takes years and years and years to get to the point where you don't take it personally. When from like age 18 to maybe even as far as age 30, it could cause major depression because you think that people are saying, no, you're not good enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not tall enough, you're not thin enough. At my age, I've certainly realized that there's an entire, and because I produce, there's an entire realm of reasons why maybe you're not cast, what the relationship is with the other person, the look of the entire cast, does it need to look like a family? And you have to learn how to not take it personally and be honest with yourself. Did you give the best audition? Were you right for the role? Or did you go in kind of cocky and thinking you had it? And you can't do that either. You have to work hard.
Yeah, work in progress and just stick to it. Couple of things you want to leave our listeners with today, I know. So I'm going to give you an open forum here. So go ahead.
Thank you. Well, first, and the main reason, and thank you so much for the opportunity
That's
to
my
be
pleasure.
Here.
Yeah.
Is just that we have auditions coming up August 17th and 18th, and we would love to see some new faces come on out. And we've had people come over from the other side, as we call it. And we might
mean,
be able to
you
help you with
this
that.
Side of the
yes.
water.
Yep, we call it the other side. But come on out, please. And you can find out all about the organization and the auditions on our website, which is www.wiccaonline.com. And then my other thing, really, I wasn't expecting to actually get to the conversation about the National Endowment for the Arts, but I would really love to continue a conversation about funding for the arts in this entire region and would love to bring together artists and the theaters at every level to discuss how we can work on these funding streams. So if there's anybody out there listening who wants to continue this conversation, please, please contact me.
Yeah, and maybe we can put a panel together and take it further.
That would be great.
That would be something I'd be interested in doing. Well, I really appreciate you being with us today. It's been fun. And what's the rest of the week like for you? What are you working on this week?
Well, actually, we were supposed to go to Ashland, Oregon, so I thought I was leaving. So now I'm not, and I'm going to go in and work on the audition list. I have a lot of local actors who would like to get together and try out their audition before they're in front of the volunteers. And actually, that's open. If somebody wants to come in and give me a call, I can meet them. And I'm in Seattle a lot, so I can meet somebody and help them pick an audition piece and practice and get ready for that audition. So it's all about getting ready. We're just a few weeks away here.
There you go. And they can do anything for that audition piece, right?
Yes, but I can help them find it if they need that kind of assistance.
Yeah, there you go. Very good. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Vicki.
And please give out Whidbey Island's address again, the URL.
Whidbey Island Center for the Arts, www.wiccaonline.com.
Thank you so much. And before we go today, I just want to let you know that J.A. Jance is coming, joining us next Monday at noon. And we also have Dr. Fasno. Is that the correct correct pronunciation, Eric?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, he's coming to talk to us about...
Fasano. Yes.
Okay, thank you. He's coming to talk to us about celiac disease. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because he is one of the leading international researchers. I sought him out because I'd heard great things about Maryland University. And I got in touch with them. And they put him forward as the expert on celiac disease. And I know this is something that is getting more and more common. So, you know, I'm never short of questions. But I want to put this out to you. If you have celiac disease or if you know somebody who does, please send me the questions that you'd like to get get answered next Monday.
My number one question, what is celiac disease?
Well, we're going to answer that next Monday.
Okay, we'll find out.
I know it has something to do with gluten. I haven't read all of the book yet, but he's put together a little book, but that's not why he's here. He's here because he really is a leading expert on this. So if you have questions on celiac disease and how to cope with that on a day-to-day basis, please do email me at info@conversationslive.net, and conversations is plural, info@conversationslive.net. Or you can leave a voicemail at our 800 number, which is 495-7617, 800-495-7617. And I want to thank you all for being with us today. We'll be back next Monday. Until then, live well, live strong.